facing the Legion. There was a local MP who was touring, a psychiatric hospital that was in his riding. The chief administrator did a very fine job of escorting the MP around and explaining the facility's procedures and treatment options and the desperate need for government financing to upgrade the equipment and the facilities. At the end of the tour, the MP thanked his host and said this, "There's still one thing I don't understand. How do you and your staff determine if someone should be admitted to this facility?" The administrator replied, "That's a good question. We administer a little test. With each new potential patient, we take them into a large bathroom where we have filled a bathtub with water. We hand the potential patient a spoon, a cup, and a bucket, and ask them how they would drain the tub of its contents." The MP replied, "Well, that's easy. I'd use the bucket. Before I go any further, how many of you would choose the bucket?" Okay. The administrator's face turned pale, and he replied, "The sane answer is you would pull the plug. Would you like a room next to a window?" Sorry for you that chose the bucket. I use this little story to set the stage for our exploration of this familiar, but rather unusual gospel story. In our modern sensibilities, we read a story about demon possession and we maybe are inclined to immediately dismiss the story as being unscientific and archaic, and archaic view of what has happened. Today, if we encountered someone like the possessed man in the story, we would assume that that person was seriously mentally ill. They were in need of treatment and probably some sort of incarceration of some kind. The man, who ambushes Jesus in our lesson today was a menace to himself and to the whole area around which he wandered. In his madness, the man lived a horrible existence. He lived among the tombs or caves where the dead were buried. Modern neuroscience would like us to believe that demonic possession really didn't have any part to play in this story. His bizarre behavior could be explained by a serious chemical imbalance in his brain, like schizophrenia, for example. Demons and demon possession, well, we think now they are old wives' tales used to explain odd and frightening behavior in a time of limited scientific knowledge. In other words, there are a lot of people today, maybe many here today, who do not believe there's such a thing as the demonic. Yet, don't you find it interesting, at least I do, how much interest there is in popular culture in exploring this subject? You ever notice that? There are lots of movies out there. There are television shows. There's books. There's even music all out there to promote the exploration of demonic themes. One of the longest running shows in the history of television was about two brothers who used to travel around the United States chasing down demons. It was called Supernatural. If such powers do not exist, why as a culture are we so fascinated by it? Now, the early gospel writers were likely not familiar with the concept of mental illness. But one thing is certain, and that is that whenever Jesus encountered people who were described as being possessed by demons, three things were always present. The first was that the demon possessed demonstrated self-destructive behavior. In this case, the man had begun to avoid wearing clothes and he would cause physical harm to himself. The second symptom apparent is that that victim of a demonic possession felt trapped in their condition. They cannot help themselves. Thus, this unnamed man is driven to animalistic behavior and is living in places reserved for the dead. And finally, those Jesus encountered who were demon-possessed were separated from family and friends. All social support was thoroughly unattainable to them. This poor man who lived among the tombs terrified anyone who came near him. Not even his own mother would be able to get near him. If confronted by someone today, or if the man was confronted by someone, he would lash out violently. Well, the goal in the Bible of any demon possession recorded is always the same: to capture us and prevent us from becoming what God intended us to be. Now, the other critical part of this story is its location. This incident takes place when Jesus arrived in the land of Gerasene, or Gadarenes, depending on your translation. The location of this incident is somewhat problematic for biblical scholars, as the three gospel writers don't seem to agree on exactly where this happened. Even in the earliest manuscripts of Luke, there is disagreement as to where Jesus encountered this demonically possessed man. The one thing we can be sure of, and what each of the gospel writers want us to understand, is that this event takes place outside of Israel. That's important. This is the land of pagans, Gentiles. It is on the other side of the Sea of Galilee, and no self-respecting Jew would ever wander over there. One reason the gospel writers might disagree on this location is that maybe none of them had ever been there before or likely would ever go there again. It was truly foreign territory to them. There is a critical and beautiful lesson that comes from the location of this story, and that is that Jesus is willing to travel outside of comfort zones to reach lost and desperate people. Jesus is willing to go among strange people who believe strange things and worship strange gods. I mean, these people ate pigs, for goodness sakes, something no God-fearing Jew would ever do. The moment Jesus sets foot in this foreign land, everything he touches going forward is unclean in the Jewish eyes. Jesus walked into an unclean land with unclean people, where there were hillsides full of unclean animals. And who is the first person he meets when he gets there? A naked, filthy, probably physically scarred, out of his mind man. A man whose only words would sound twisted and animalistic. Any sensible person encountering someone like this man would run in the opposite direction. I've had encounters here in Simcoe where occasionally I encounter someone who is clearly, in my mind, mentally ill. Often we run into them in public places like the park or downtown streets. Perhaps we find them muttering to themselves, although with Bluetooth technology, it's sometimes hard to figure out who's actually mentally ill these days. Often they are dirty, unclean. They're wearing ragged clothes. They're disrupting the peace that all of us long to experience. And normally when we encounter someone like that, what do? We keep our distance, right? We do it out of fear, because we don't know what they're going to do. Fear that we might say something that would set that person off. If we are uncomfortable with these folks, imagine encountering the man that Jesus meets. Michael Rognes makes a great comment when he writes that the man Jesus meets that day is essentially already in a living death. Living death. Unlike the walking dead or zombies, this man moved quickly and with mindless ferocity. A living death. Dare you let me say it's like hell on earth. Now here's the meat of what I want us to think about in this passage today. Is there still demonic activity in our world today? Or can we just explain everything away with science? Let me rephrase it a bit. If being under demonic possession is what Michael Rognes calls a living death, are there people today who are experiencing a living death? I personally believe that if we call it a living death, there are still demonic forces at play in this world. But I also believe that their strategy, or the demonic strategy, the evil strategy, whatever you want to call it, is becoming increasingly subtler out of necessity. I say this because a man like the one Jesus encountered would today have been immediately arrested or locked up and heavily medicated, wouldn't he? He or she would still be in a living death, but now the destructive goals of that influence would be greatly diminished by lock and key and dopamine. So I wonder if the demonic has not changed tactics. Now, those who are in a living death, what happens to them? They suffer from addiction, obsessions, paranoia, destructive habits, and many other such things. The states of living death that we encounter are no less destructive, maybe even more so, but they do not always fall under criminal activity. Did you read in the newspaper of that terrible shooting in Minnesota recently? I could argue easily that that was demonic. But like all demonic activity, the three characteristics I mentioned earlier, they still apply to those around us who are in the living death. Take addiction, for example. A person who is under the power of addiction, they are causing harm to themselves. They feel trapped in their circumstances, and they end up being separated from family and friends. Those wrestling with addiction usually find themselves unable to reach their God-given potential. I chose addiction as an example because of the fine work of groups like Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous and all the related organizations. Those groups help people find their way back out of the darkness. But it's also interesting to me that in our modern scientific age, the most effective treatment for addictions begins with a thing called the 12-step program. Are you familiar with this? And the 12-step program begins with three steps. First, we admit we are powerless over our addiction and our lives have become unmanageable. That's step one. Step two, we come to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, we decided to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him. That's the first three steps. AA programs recognize our need for God to deliver us from living death. Did you know that in the former Soviet Union, before the fall of communism, alcoholism was a really serious problem? Very bad. And back then, before the collapse of communism, Soviet officials appealed to the American AA members to help them set up AA groups in the USSR. However, because the Soviet Union is officially atheistic, they asked that these first three steps be omitted in adapting the program for them. The Americans refused. They said that these steps were crucial to the success of every member who took that program. Members of AA or NA or whatever group that you want to point out all recognize their need for God's help. All of them. But they also need the support of family and friends. In every story of Jesus healing someone from demonic possession, the person was immediately restored to community. The goal of exorcising demons was always restoration. Healing what was fractured, mostly relationships, making the person whole. Being made free from our demons is not a do-it-yourself project. We need God. We need other people. We need community. No one living in isolation ever escapes the state of living death or hell on earth, whatever you want to call it. Being in isolation just adds to the torment. That is why AA has meetings open to anyone, and you can go to as many as you want or you need in your life. They also have sponsors who work tirelessly to help someone just starting out on that road to recovery. Now I know all of you this morning are sitting there thinking to yourself, but what about the pigs in the story? I wondered about that. I mean, look at the outrage we heard when wild animals have to be put down in our society or in our world. Imagine what the SPCA would have said or PETA would have said about this herd of pigs. The demons, they knew who Jesus was and what he was going to do. They knew. His presence had caused them no end of pain. Light does that to darkness. Instead of banishing them back to hell, Jesus allows them to leave the man and head straight to the pigs. Regardless of what we think about or think about the pigs, the scene is a very symbolic one. Pigs, remember, in Israel among Jewish people were considered unclean. So what better place was there for unclean spirits to dwell than in a herd of pigs? But that dark presence going into the animals drives them immediately insane, and they promptly destroy themselves. The scene ends beautifully with the man clothed in his right mind, sitting at Jesus' feet, worshiping him. It's a great story, a happy ending. But is it really? Normally when Jesus heals someone, we never get to see what happens to the person right after the healing. They get healed and Jesus moves on. And what we learn about the aftermath of this exorcism is not very encouraging. When news of the demonic healing and the destruction of the pigs makes it back to the locals, the people beg Jesus to leave. Why would they ask the person who healed the man no one else could help be asked to leave? Well, the Bible tells us the reason. They were terrified. They were afraid. And what exactly are they afraid of here? Maybe they're afraid that these demons now on the loose might come back to their villages and inhabit someone else. Remember, these are pagan folks. These are people who are likely very superstitious. This may be why someone didn't just put an arrow into that man years ago. Wouldn't it have been easier to just get rid of that menace? But again, maybe they feared that by killing that man, the demons would get loose and take vengeance on the community. Maybe it was fear based on economics. I mean, who wants to lose another herd of pigs? Isn't it easier to just avoid this man than lose a great amount of wealth? As a society, we make that awful choice all the time with vulnerable people among us. It costs a lot of people to keep someone in a psychiatric facility long term. So if that person's not a danger to themselves or others, we let them go out onto the street to live a meager existence on the fringe of society. It's cheaper. Or maybe it was simply that people don't like change. Whatever the reason they ask Jesus to go, they beg Jesus to go. Did you notice how much begging there is in this story? The demons beg Jesus to let them go and live in the pigs. The people beg Jesus to leave, and the man begs Jesus to let him go with them. In response, Jesus allows the demons to enter the pigs. He agrees to leave the territory, but he does not allow the man to come with him. That's odd, isn't it? The people who encounter Jesus are left in a complete tizzy. The man who is healed is left by Jesus to face an uncertain future in a town where the people would not know what to do with him. So often in the scriptures, people who meet Jesus have their whole worlds turned upside down. They end up being scarred by his awesome, life-changing, transforming power. There's no way going back to the way things were before the demons entered this man. He'll never get there. That is what happens when Jesus exorcises the demons from us. He sends us in a direction we had not foreseen. In the book of Hebrews, we read this. It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of a living God. When you are amid the living death from whatever demon has a hold of you, there's no going back when Christ delivers you. None. Like the man in the story, he will call us to a new state of freedom to share that good news with other people. It's no wonder then that some people just don't want to let go of their demons. They know if Christ delivers them, their lives will be radically altered. Things will not be the same. The truth that is inherently connected to this story is that we can refuse the grace and love God offers us. We can do that. We can, by our own choice, decide to remain in that living death. I am not sure our possessed man in the passage would be capable of such a refusal, as he was so far gone. But many people today, they refuse all the time. Many others can and have decided to dwell in their own with their own personal demons, rather than have their lives turned upside down by God's grace. I don't know if I ever told you one of my favorite stories of a famed healer who suddenly appeared on the beach at Port Dover. Have I told you about this guy? And the healer preacher had soon acquired quite a following and a reputation from people all around the area. They knew if they could come, they could be healed. One fine summer day, the healer was strolling along the beach and he came upon a blind man. He immediately laid hands on the man, prayed, and immediately the man's sight was restored. And the blind man jumped up and ran across the beach celebrating. Then the healer encountered a woman with a terrible, severe skin condition. Again, he laid hands on her, and again she was healed, leading to great celebration on that beach. And by now the whole beach, the whole town was buzzing with excitement. And next, the healer came upon a man who was obviously suffering from severe back issues because he wore a very cumbersome brace around his middle. And the healer was about to lay hands on him when the man stopped him. The man said, I really appreciate the kindness, preacher, but I'll pass. Why? The healer asked. Well, to tell you the truth, I just got my first disability check. You see, it means change. Do you want deliverance? Are you prepared for the ways such deliverance will change your life? Is there darkness in your life that needs intervention from the light of the world that we sang about with the kids? And come, I ask you, come and kneel before the Son of God and be set free.